everybody. I'm Andy Weinberg, and welcome to episode 54 of the David Wasikanen In the Pocket podcast here on wildfireradio.com and live on phillyrockradio.com. And as always, you can find all our episodes at in-the-pocket.simplecast.com or wherever else you get your podcast. Dave and I are happy to be back after a one-week absence, and we're even happier to have, as our guest this week, calling us from his home in Chicago on the line, the extremely talented multi-instrumentalist, musician, producer, songwriter, keyboardist, and plays a lot of other stuff as well. His name is DC Collard. You might know him from his band, The. You might know him from the Joe Boxers, great 80s new wave band back in the day.
New wave.
And he's got an incredible new solo album that he's just finished, and it will be available soon. It's one of the most honest and personal records you'll ever hear, and yet the lyrics are extremely relatable, his experiences, and we're going to talk all about that today on the show. So, DC, thanks for being here. Welcome.
And I'd like to thank you, Dave, Andy, and Taylor for inviting me. Appreciate it.
It's good to have you. Actually, Andy was just mentioning that it's been a week, but I feel like I haven't been in the studio in about a month. So it's kind of nice. It was like the intro and everything. And it's so great to be back here and have you on the podcast, DC. It's great, man. You know, I mean, we've been friends for a long time.
Dave was telling me before we went on that that you guys have a pretty long history together, that you used to hang out together back in your wild and young days back in the 80s.
Well, yeah, and I'll bet there's a few stories that Dave doesn't want me telling on there.
But it's fine.
I can mention it's maybe fine. In 1985, the Judas decided to play some shows in London.
Oh, God.
And I seem to remember Dave turning up at my apartment, and we spent a night trailing around the various pubs of London.
My God.
No good, and I think we'll leave it at that.
Oh, man. You know what, Dave? DC, I forgot about... You know, the one thing I do always recall, I remember, is when we worked with Donald Camel doing All You Zombies. And I remember at dinner, and it was an interesting dinner because Camel had a group of people that were extras in the video. And we went to a pub and had a traditional English experience with food. And I remember I couldn't wait to get out of there because I was meeting you and a few of your friends at another pub, which is out of town. And because it was a day of where I was kind of getting into extracurricular activity as far as drugs and for me. I'm not talking about you, but I used to go and go, hey, you know where I can find this stuff? And I remember it being a hell of a night. And I missed my call the next day for the video because in England they had these wacky alarms that would go off in your... It was a built-in alarm in the hotel room. I even forget the hotel we were staying in, but it sounded like a foghorn. And I thought, oh, that's got to be a mistake. And it went off, and I somehow slept through the next one. And I remember getting in the van, and everybody just... They weren't even angry at me. They were laughing because I looked like a mess. But I had a great time with DC over there. And but I actually, until you brought it up, I forgot about the night of going to the clubs. There was a club in London called the Hippodrome. Was it the Hippodrome or something?
Hippodrome. Yeah, there's Hippodrome, which also that you did good gigs there as well. Nightclub. So I played there a few times.
I bet you have, man. I bet you have.
And the Electric Ballroom, right? All around that Camden area.
Yeah.
Actually, I remember in the early days, in the very first band I was in, a band called God Is Dark out of Bristol, and we had Miles Copeland managing.
Right.
Us, and he was also managing, obviously, the Police at that time in Squeeze. So we wound up being the support band for the Police and Squeeze.
Wow.
Which was kind of baptism of fire.
For right.
You got Miles Copeland, you know, CIA black belt.
Exactly.
Karate.
Yeah. And oh, was he a black belt karate? I didn't know that because I knew him because
he was an interesting character, but my lead guitarist and singer kind of fell out with him. So that kind of went kind of a little nap. But what happened actually out of that was I got hooked up with Bernie Rhodes, who was the manager of The Clash at the time. He put me with Vic Goddard, and then I joined the Subway set. So I went really from this kind of just out of school straight into, you know, I'd been playing like in school bands, straight into like some pretty heavy stuff.
Oh, it was gigantic. I remember. I mean, all the stuff that you were doing was so super cool, and I was always impressed by that. Is he doing that? And then, and that scene there was really pretty remarkable for his. You know, kid out of Philadelphia. Right. I remember coming there, just being blown away by it. You know, and we played there. We played the Marquee Club a number of times, but I remember just right. I really liked my experience with you back in the day, and it was so cool that you ended up back here for quite a long time too, and now you're basically a mainstay in the U.S. It's I like the whole. Trajectory of your like all living life, how you've kind of done some really interesting stuff.
And we're gonna hear all of
well,
that.
Well, thank you. Yeah. I just to bring things into context. Yeah, I did live in the Philly area for about 6 or 7 years, so right. You can count me as one of your local artists.
Yeah.
Well, there you go. There you go. We got the Philly connection from DC.
That's why, because we were talking about it in the pie. I said, Dave, at DC, I got to get you something on the program in the pocket someday. And he constantly, because right. He lived here for 6 years, he's in.
There you go. So he's got the Philly connection. We'll hear a little more about the Philly connection, Adam. We'll hear a lot more about DC's career and what he's doing now, because you have to hear these new songs from him. I do want to mention our sponsors before we go any further. We're brought to you once again this week by the fantastic people at gotpeace.com, our friend Trudy Handelman.
Amazing.
And the great stuff she does over there. And what she does, she brings a message of peace to the community, the country, and the world. And she does it with some really cool merchandise. They've got hats, shirts, dog tag necklaces that promote different charities. And my favorites, they're plush love cows and peace cows. You can actually get the full set. So with Christmas and Hanukkah coming up, promoting messages of peace is a great gift idea. Plus, a portion of all sales goes to helping people fight cancer. And you go on our website, if you spend $39.90, you get 10%, a coupon for 10% off. So you save a little money there, you give a gift, and you promote peace. Check them out on the web at gotpeace.com, or if you want more information, you can call them at 424-343-1213. Also want to mention that we're sponsored again this week by Corporate Sedan Service, providing first-class ground transportation to the entire Philadelphia region and beyond. You know, when you travel, you've got enough to worry about without stressing over how you're getting to and from the airport or your hotel or the train or wherever you're going. Yeah. So why not forget all the stress and leave all the arrangements up to Corporate Sedan? Owner Greg Fox and his courteous and professional team of dispatchers and drivers provide reliable, luxurious, and personal service 24 hours a day. So whether you're traveling for business or pleasure, give Corporate Sedan a call at 215-860-6564. Or visit them on the web at www.sedanservice.com. And they're also always looking to hire drivers. So if you're interested in working for them, you can also give them a call, again, at 215-860-6564.
Way to go.
All right. So
it's the way to go.
We're back on the line with left the line. D.C. Collard.
I'm still here, yeah.
Yeah. So... why don't we start? Sometimes we'll start all the way in the past, but I think we need to start with the current, because you've put out this album. I was listening to these tracks last night, DC. This is great stuff. The album is called On a Mission. And it's your, if I'm not mistaken, it's your very first solo album, correct?
That is correct.
Congratulations.
And actually, the album itself is not coming out till mid-February. So there's been two releases so far. On the October 15th, Like a Child Crucified came out. And then a couple of days ago, the 19th of November, KC Blue, also known as Kansas City Blue, is out. So those are two things that are out and available. And if you feel like dropping 99 cents on each of those, I'd really appreciate it.
Yeah, do it.
Yeah, go on his website, dccollard.com, or then you can go on wherever you buy your songs. Talk about, obviously these songs are incredibly... personal for you, for people who don't know. I'm going to let you get into the story, but you lived in Malaysia for the first 10 years of your life. Your parents were missionaries. And then when you were, I guess, 10 years old, you got sent to boarding school in England. So it's a wild life you led, and you're not, you know, only, exactly. at 10 years old, you've already had all these experiences of that, you know, most of us will never experience. Talk about how these experiences inspired the album.
Well, as you rightly surmise, it's somewhat autobiographical. I mean, there's some artistic license, but it's more like an old style, what I would call maybe like, not musically, it's pretty modern musically, but it has sort of a reference to the old sort of concept albums of the 70s, where it's a bit of a a storyline. It kind of starts at the beginning, there's a middle and an end.
Nice.
So the beginning really is me. When I was born, I was born in Malaysia, and I literally didn't come to England until I was nine, nearly 10 years old. Mm. So my whole life revolved around Malaysia. Now, the first 4 years of my life, I was down in the plains, so it was real hot. The only kind of music I was hearing was pump organ church music and really wild Chinese opera. If you can imagine those two as being formative years.
That explains it all.
Wild so a delicious cacophony. And anyhow, so I had this going on. Then when I'm 4 years old, I move up into the rainforest, into the jungles, up into the mountains.
My God.
Just for your information, the rainforest in Malaysia is actually the oldest rainforest in the world, older than the Amazon. Wow. And I literally lived in that jungle for the next 6 years.
Wow.
And I had a free run there. I'm a 7 year old with a couple of shoes on. So I'd be like wearing what we used to call sand shoes, which were like really flimsy sneakers, basically. Right. I'd have a short pair of shorts on and a machete in my right hand, no shirt.
Tarzan.
And a large German shepherd.
Wow.
A large German shepherd called King by my side. Wow. And the two of us would literally roam the jungle on our own. My parents had absolutely no fear. I came back every time.
Wow.
And it was an amazing beginning to life. But like I say, musically, it was peculiar. Okay? So I didn't really have anything that you guys would like reference in terms of your early years, you know, 60s, 70s music, whatever.
Yeah.
And there I am. I go to school there.
Wow.
So this school is literally in a jungle clearing. And I, out of this kind of weird beginning, I get stuck on a plane at the age of 9 years old and sent on my own. On a plane. I'm the first
That's scary, man.
In my family, right.
Yeah.
We're talking the end of 1968.
Yeah. Yeah.
Nobody goes on a plane unless you're really rich, right?
Right.
So it's a big deal. And I'm kind of like, so like a child crucified is basically this feeling, getting on that plane and kind of sacrificing it for my family, putting on a brave face.
Wow.
You know, I'm scared. I'm thinking all these things, but it's also an adventure.
Mm.
So my child mind basically shuts down and deals with what I can deal with.
Mm.
And that is the beginning of my English experience. When I land in England, I'm in another world. I mean, you can't imagine. You're in this country that's hot, it's bright, it's beautiful, it's colorful.
Yeah.
The next minute, you're in a cold country where it's wet, rainy, gray, and gloomy.
Yeah.
And you're like, what the hell am I
just
doing
experienced
here?
Well, even the very first line of the song, "Like a Child Crucified," how am I supposed to live in this foreign land?
Yeah.
I mean, that's you sum it up right there. And then and then later in the song, you have a line, "How will I count the ways I'm still loved?"
Mm.
Because I'm sure there was, you know, your parents send you off to this, like you say, this foreign land.
Right.
You must have felt, why me? What did I do wrong? Why are they sending me away? I mean, I can't imagine
there
the feeling.
There was an element. Yeah, there was an element of that. The reason I was given is that in Malaysia at that time, they'd had the Merdeka Day where they became free of the English. I think that was back in 57.
Mm-hmm.
And so they were getting very, very nationalistic. And the Malays were like, because there's a three-culture system there. It's basically the Malays, the Indians, and the Chinese. And the Malays were trying to assert themselves.
Uh-huh.
And they would, everyone had a common language, and that was English.
Yes.
And at that point in time, they were changing all the schools over to just speaking in Malay.
Yeah.
And there was this kind of push to make it Malaysia, rather.
Wow.
So my parents were like, well, you know, you really need to go to the country where you speak. Now, to them, it was their home country. To me, as you rightly point out, it was a foreign country.
Malaysia was your country.
But I sort of understood I was doing this for my education.
Mm-hmm.
But did I really give a shit about my education?
No.
Not really.
No.
I would rather stay in the jungle and have some fun. But there was one silver lining that you must have guessed by now, and that was
music.
The first thing that really I could hold on to was music.
Yeah.
And when I came to England, we're talking the Beatles.
Yeah.
We're talking all sorts of
68, 67, single, the best year of all.
End of 68.
Yeah.
And then 69, 70, 71. And so really, I wasn't buying records until I was like, it was in the 70s.
Mm.
My first record I ever owned was a 45 Lola. by the Kinks.
Right. Oh, that's a great way to start.
Great record.
And the first album was Deep Purple in Rock.
How about that? Yeah, there you go.
So I got a good story about that.
And John Lord. Awesome.
Well, John Lord for sure.
Yeah. Wow.
So,
Dave, real quick, did you ever see the movie 300? Do you know?
Yeah.
You know when they throw the kid in the jungle, and it's like he's like, and I was, when you were telling the story, I was thinking you're like the kid they threw out there when you talked about you with the sneakers and the flimsy sneakers and the machete, but you end up going to the jungle, the concrete jungle of England, which is pretty remarkable because you got to make it work and the whole story. I mean, it's fascinating, and then you put this to music, remarkable. It really is.
Well, I'll tell you something. I had no intention of making an album, right?
Uh-huh.
This thing just kind of happened.
Uh-huh.
And a lot of it happened, I guess, because I'd started to go back to Malaysia after 40 years. I'd met up with some of the kids I went to school with.
No, wow.
And they were, the last time I'd seen them, they were 7 or 8 years old. It was amazing. 40 years later, we look at each other and, man, I recognize you. We recognize each other. And we literally just carried on from where we left off.
Oh, my gosh. Bizarre. Wow.
A real mate of mine, Neil Chenoweth, he's actually a fabulous guy. He's an investigative journalist over in Australia, Sydney.
Wow.
He comes up to me and says, mate, I'm really sorry. I'm like, what are you talking about? Well, that punch-up we got into, and I have no recollection of it at all. I said, who won? He said, I don't remember. I just always felt sorry that I never said sorry. And I said, look, we gave each other a big hug, and I said, you know what? I'm sorry too, but I hope I won.
The punch out. I love it. Oh, that's great. Oh.
But it was fantastic. But anyhow, so really the catalyst was maybe this going back. And before I knew it, this album just kind of came out of me. I had no intention to sit down and write an album.
Uh-huh.
The bulk of the album was written within 2 weeks. It was weird.
Wow.
I mean, it was very, very strange.
And you played pretty much everything on the album, correct?
Everything you hear, I did. There's a few samples I've used, like of Oriental Instruments, but I've, kind of manipulated.
Where did you record the record? Where did you
I did it at my home.
Awesome.
It's what I call the White Witch Jungle Studios.
Uh-huh.
And that's where I live and breathe.
Yeah. Wow.
And it was one of those things where initially when it started coming together, I was kind of demoing it.
Yeah.
And as I'm demoing, I'm thinking, this isn't a demo, this is a record.
Yeah, it sounded
great.
And
I was thinking, I'll get my son, Blaise Collard, who is an exceptional drummer, as you know, Dave.
Yes.
And I was thinking of getting these other people to come and play on it. But then I realized that really it was such a personal record that it almost had to just be me.
Yes.
Just to do this. I mean, the next album's going to be with other players on it. Sure.
Yeah.
But it just for this particular experience, it just seemed right. And there were so many things about this record that were totally different from any record I've done.
Mm.
For one, I never mixed it. I was mixing as I was going along.
Uh-huh.
All I did was at the end, I'd run them off, and then I went and mastered it.
Uh-huh.
It was like it was a really interesting experience. It caused some joy, some pain, and some pleasure all rolled up in one.
Yeah.
But I'm very, very, very pleased with the way it turned out. I mean, I can still hear things. Of course, you're a musician. You understand.
Sure.
So I think, this could be better. That could, but basically, as a piece of work, I'm very happy with. If you want to give the audience a little play,
I was just going to say, let's give the audience a taste of the new album, On a Mission, from DC Collard. This is the first single, Like a Child Crucified.
Supposed to live in this foreign land? How am I supposed to give with nothing in my hand? How will I count the ways that say I am still loved all alone, so far away from home? Child crucified. seat on a plane to foreign lands, on a journey of deceit, like a child crucified. I focused on the pain, then numbed myself to everything, so nothing hurt again. I no longer look for love. I just keep rolling forward like a robot in a crowd. My mind ever empty, my heart hard as rock. Tears are dry, the streaks are crust. There's nothing left to shock. Boy machine moving through this life. Give me something I can feel, something that is real. Yeah, something I can feel that's real.
Like a child crucified.
Like a child crucified. I buckle in my seat. Journey of deceit,
like a child,
crucified. I focus on the pain, then numb myself to everything, so nothing hurts again.
Like a child,
like
crucified.
A child, crucified.
Father, behold your son.
Theater, man. I'm hearing that and I'm thinking, this is like, you know, this is not just an album, man. This is the story is remarkable. And I it just, you know, there's a Floyd thing to it. Like, you know, I've always been a fan of what Roger Waters and David Gilmour and Nick Mason and those guys have done, and the way you present this story is so clever.
It definitely seems like the first track of a concept album.
Oh, I mean, that's, no question. And I was actually closing my eyes and I was visualizing. That's really something, Dave. TC, it's great. I keep on doing. I'm sorry. It's really
that's
amazing.
All right. You can call the
I'm
as
sorry.
We,
it's like a bad habit of mine. Here we go.
It's
anyone great.
Anyone that knew me before the early 90s pretty much still called me Dave. Interchanges between Dave and Dave.
Yeah,
if you say Dave, no
problem. You were telling the story that I guess everybody, there was a bunch of Daves back in the day, so everybody decided to go by initials. Is that how it worked?
Right. So when I joined Verdun, we're talking 1989. Yeah. So we're preparing to do the Mind Bomb tour.
Wow.
And the band, well, it's a hell of a band. Yeah, got Johnny Marr on guitar.
Yeah.
Matt Johnson, obviously, singing and rhythm guitar. James Eller, bass, and Dave Palmer on drums.
Yeah.
And, yes, Dave is a Dave, of course. So
yeah.
He was DP. I'm a Dave. I'm a DC.
Yeah.
There was a couple of Daves in the crew.
Yeah.
And it was essential to have other names. Otherwise, everyone was answering Dave.
It's that. It's Dave Clark's fault.
There you go.
Hey, man. Yeah.
So that's the way we sorted it.
Yeah. Yeah, well, that's a good way to do it.
What happened was, just so that it kind of became sealed, was Matt when we did the Dusk album.
Great record.
Without asking me, and it was quite fine because I'm cool with just about anything Matt would ever do.
Hey, sure.
He just put down a DC Collard on the album, and from that moment on, it's.
I like it.
So that's the.
I like
story.
It. I like it. I'm happy to hear that you're reunited with Matt in 2018.
Yeah, it's actually
such a terrific band.
It's a slightly different setup.
Yeah.
It's obviously Matt. I'm on the keyboards. James Eller is still on the bass.
Yeah.
We've got Earl Harvin on drums.
Uh-huh.
He's a monster.
Yeah, I know him. He's great.
Fantastic player.
Yeah.
Earl. And then we've got Barry Condogan on guitar. Little Barry. Now, you may not know who he is, but if you've ever seen Better Call Saul, if you hear that beautiful little guitar lift that happens before it goes to commercial, that's Barry Condogan.
Wow. Oh, wow. I love Better Call Saul, as does Dave.
Yeah, that's, big fan.
Didn't realize there was a the connection to Better Call Saul.
Yeah, the Barry Condogan, fantastic guitar player. Mm. It's actually this band. I don't want to say better than the 89 band, but it's perfect for now.
It sounds wonderful.
In the way I think it's better. Anyway, I think it is better.
And it's great that Matt, obviously, you know, he's the catalyst putting it back together, if I'm not mistaken. But it's great that he wanted to do the again, because it was such a great band, and they always made great records. So I was really happy to hear that, you know.
Hey, getting back to
it. Well, you could be even happier to know that we're slated to do another record, a brand new the record. Later next year. Now, I can't tell you when that's coming out.
Wonderful.
But I also can tell you that when we toured in 2018, we did an Albert Hall show that was filmed by Tim Pope. At some point next year, that should be coming out along with a live album. So that's something also to look at.
And tour dates in the United States?
I'm thinking that it probably won't happen until 2021, but, you know, I'm not the agent, so
right.
We better hold off on that one.
Yeah.
Hey, just getting back to the new album for a little bit more. One thing that I think will strike people if they after hearing that first track is the very different musical styles on some of the songs. The next single, KC Blue, is kind of a little funky thing. You know, more Stevie more Stevie Wonder than Pink Floyd. You know, so is that something that you were conscious of when you're making this record of trying to, you know, kind of mix up the styles a little bit?
To be honest, there was no preconceived notion. This thing just came out of me. It was almost like it was there, and all I had to do was just access it. And the stylistic thing is strange to me in a way, because I didn't plan any of the styles of the songs. I just did the songs the way they sounded in my head. And what's bizarre is that it seems to work. And I think maybe it's partly because of the continuity of the storyline, but I think maybe it's the fact that I'm doing it, that it kind of ties it together. I'm not entirely sure why it works, but yeah, there was no preconceived plan.
Well, just to give people, I don't know if we're going to play this full song because I want to make sure we have enough time to talk because we have so much we want to talk to you about. But let's just, Taylor, play the beginning of KC Blue. We'll play like a minute or so of that just to hear how different this one sounds than Like a Child Crucified.
Maybe you could get up into the guitar solo.
Sure.
That'd be cool.
South with a heavy load. It ain't a weight measured by the pound. That ton of trouble buried way underground. Down, 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 underground. Down, 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 underground. Down, 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 underground. Down, 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 underground. Kansas City. Gotta breathe in clean air to breathe out the hurt. Now feeling the sun washing over my face. Though some memories I just can't erase from down, 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 underground. Down, 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 underground. Down, down. there's something blue now. Checkered parts, but now it's time for me to rise. Yes, it's time for me to rise. Kansas City, here I come. 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 Kansas City, here I come.
It's weird, but you got, it's got a little hip hop thing to it too. It's really cool, man. It's I love what you're doing.
That's an interesting story behind this. Okay, so this was the first song I wrote on the album, so it was out of order. But I was actually on my motorcycle riding from Chicago to visit a friend of mine who I went to school with when we were both 7 and 8 years old in the jungles of Malaysia, living in Kansas City, Missouri. So I'm on the bike, and literally this entire song, lyrics, melody, the whole thing
came to you.
Happened on that motorcycle.
That's interesting. How do you, so when you write something like that, so you, it came to you, so it all, because I always think about, as I get older, recall. I have my phone, and I'm always writing notes and lyrics, stuff like that. How did you, when you wrote it, did you pull over, like were you riding a bike, and I'm pull over, I got to remember that. What did you do? Did you use the app to record? What did you do?
Yeah, so what I did was, as the song was coming into my mind, I have a pretty good memory, right?
It must.
So, yeah, so and it came into my mind, and the lyrics just kept coming, but the melody came with the lyrics.
Yeah.
Usually, I write the music and then the lyrics, but for a lot of these songs, the lyrics and music came at the same time, the melody. So I'm singing it into my helmet as I'm going along, right? And, you know, and I change a couple of things here, and then I keep singing it. By the time I got to Kansas City, I hung out with my friend, and I totally forgot about it. I stayed there for a long weekend. I rode back to Chicago.
Right.
The next morning when I woke up, it was in my head, running in my head as I woke up. We're talking 4 days later.
Mm-hmm.
So I went into my studio. I literally, you know, typed out the lyrics, of which only one word has been changed since that type.
Wow.
And the music basically, you know, obviously I built the arrangement a little bit, but the general thing, and what's really cool is that the person I was going to visit turned out to be the girl that painted the album cover.
Huh?
Oh, wow.
36x36 inch oil painting. So I don't know if you've seen the cover, but
I saw it on your website. Yeah, it's a beautiful painting. Yeah.
Wow.
And she was the one that painted it. And again, I didn't know I was writing an album, so we didn't really talk about it then. I remember when I got back and then all these other songs started coming out, I called her up and I said, you know, I like your paintings. If I ever do an album, would you be interested in painting the cover? And she said, sure. That's how that happened.
Wow. You know, getting back to the whole Malaysia thing, I'm still, I'm so impressed. Now, the connection with all your friends from Malaysia back then, was that because of what's happened with social media? Was it easier because of social media with, like, connecting with people? And how, you know, how did that happen, you know? That's
good,
it's
good
fascinating
point.
To me.
It actually was started by a girl called Kirsten Lead, who... There's an interesting story about her. Her parents sent her to that school when she was 5 years old. She's from Denmark. She didn't even speak a word of English. And she comes to this school, and she has to learn how to speak a language just completely from nothing.
Wow.
So there's some weird stories connected to this. But anyhow, she starts this private Facebook site.
Yeah.
Now, I am a social media novice. I actually started... officially social media 2 months ago.
I know. I've been talking to her. That's how we were like trying to help them with stuff. It's great.
However, I did get introduced to it a few years ago. I think it was around 2013, 2014 on a private site.
Mm-hmm.
So I had, you know, I had the personal David Collard Facebook thing, but I never used it publicly. It was just to get on this site.
Right.
So yes, it was social media that kind of connected and got this whole ball rolling.
All right.
Which, you know, ultimately... brought the album out.
Right. Yeah. In your case, it's been a real positive thing. Sometimes there's people that said, God, why did I ever get in the Facebook or the social media thing? Because some of the people that can track you down. But I love that it's been such a positive experience for you. And maybe it's because you waited a little while to get involved and do it. But you seem to be doing it the right way. And I love that it's been a very cool experience for you. It's been nice.
And Dave, while we're at it, anyone that wants to get on their Twitter or wants to get on their Instagram at DC Collard, just get on there, help me out, because I need to build this thing.
Yes.
And like I said, I've been doing it 2 months, and I need people.
Yeah.
And I would really appreciate it. And I've got to say, while I have a chance, I'd really like to thank all the people that have supported me so far. And there's been a lot.
Yeah.
And I want to put that out there. I'm going to give a couple of name checks.
Mm.
I'm going to talk about one guy who's up on a ladder right now, listening to it in England on headphones while he's painting a ceiling.
His name is
Lee Harrison. He's
right
a massive Zerda fan, but he has also transferred his support to me, which I really appreciate. It went to 15 of the shows last year.
Wow.
And there's a bunch of guys like that. Another guy that comes to mind is Will Douglas. So shout out to you two guys. Appreciate your help and support. And to all my friends and family, again, really appreciate it.
Yeah, he's got a and DC, if you don't mind, like his son is an amazing drummer. Both his Bond and Blaze are I'm a big fan of his
you're talking about my son.
Yes, your son. He said they're amazing drummer Blaze, and Bond is always like blew me away with his, you know, he's just a remarkable guy.
Bond is now working in the LA office for Sirius
XM. That's so great.
They both sound really well.
He's fearless. He's fearless. And Blaze, you know, he came on the road with us, you know, and he's become a great drummer.
It was
great. Yeah. So it was always great to hang with them. And Blaze is now doing great things. I think he's in New England now. He's in doing stuff in New England and Boston area. You know, you got to be a great drummer.
Let me give a shout out to his band, Chuggernaut.
Yeah.
They're real heavy. They're really good musicians. You need to go check them out.
Yeah.
There you go. Hey, DC, you mentioned living in Philly for a while, and obviously we like to talk up the Philly connections with our guests. What years were you in Philly, and what are your recollections of them?
So I moved to Philly. It was around 91.
Yeah.
Okay, so it was around the time I was recording the Dust album. So I was in England quite a lot. But my kids and wife at the time came over, I believe, around early 91.
Yeah.
And then I joined them later after I'd finished recording the Dusk album.
Yeah.
So I was there, and then I moved to Los Angeles, I believe, end of 96.
I remember we'd have coffee from time to time in L.A. because I lived out there, and I'd meet Dave in Studio City, and we'd have coffee, and he'd play me something because you were into the symphonic. I remember you doing some pretty out there stuff. You played me, and I would meet you at this coffee spot, and you'd play me stuff. But you were
another Philly transplant.
Yes,
from the West Coast.
Yeah, I was out there for almost 20 years. I was out in Southern California.
Yeah.
You know. So what'd you think of it when you were here? Obviously, you liked it, obviously, I would imagine.
Yeah, no, I did like Philly, you know, and I like the history of Philly. I mean, there's been so much great music come out of Philly.
Dude.
I mean, that's enough right there.
Yeah,
it was a good experience. I also liked it because I thought it was a good place for my kids to be brought up.
Yeah.
And particularly Bond, who was on the spectrum, and he got amazing assistance. So I got to say, Pennsylvania, right on. You know, those guys really helped out. We're talking about the government and the help that can be given to people on the autism spectrum. Yeah. It was massive.
Yeah, he's a remarkable.
So, yeah, let's do that for Philly, even more than your music for that.
Indeed.
What speaking about music, did you have see any memorable shows when you were living in Philly, any memorable gigs or venues that you were particularly fond of when you were here?
Well, I did go to the Spectrum a couple of times, and it's usually when a friend of mine was coming through, like a friend of mine was playing with Dire Straits, and I go and see that. I wasn't a massive Dire Straits fan, although Money for Nothing, I always thought that was a great track, even though they considered it kind of like a throwaway track.
right.
So I did go to the Spectrum from time to time. I think I saw Joe Jackson one time. I can't remember if that was at the Spectrum. But, great music there. I played, obviously, there a bunch of times. Right. Played there with Dada, played there with Jewel, played there with Josh Clayton Felt. I don't know if you remember that name. He's no longer with us. He was the singer for School of Fish.
Okay, all right.
Fantastic talent, just a wonderful guy who passed away with testicular cancer in 2000, which is very sad. He's a really close friend. But I played two or three gigs with him there. And yeah, so I've been in and out of Philly a lot. And actually, 2018, we only did two shows in New York. And it was kind of a whistle stop tour just to get across the world. You know, we did a couple of nights in Sydney Opera House, three nights in London, Royal Albert Hall, that kind of deal. So it was just, and it was funny because it was called the Comeback Special Tour. It was kind of a nod to Elvis.
Sure.
But we hadn't played. I mean, Matt hadn't been on a stage in, like, I don't know, since 2003. Him and I hadn't actually played together since 97, I think it was, you know. So it was really quite something. But a fantastic experience.
Did it take a little time for you guys to get comfortable again on stage, or was it like you'd never left when the reunited?
Oh man, it was so fast. See, one thing you got to remember, Matt and I actually, and he brought this up when he was doing initial interviews for the tour, was that it turned out that him and I have worked together most than he's worked with any other person, music wise. Mm. Just that's the way it's worked out, and it's amazing. Him and I have a kind of almost like a telepathic understanding. Like he'll say, could you do something here? Yeah. I'll know exactly what he wants.
Yeah.
And he said this in the interview. Basically, it's so fast. It's just like he kind of transmits to me what he's a fantastic. I mean, the guy is a genius, right?
Yeah.
Let's all agree that.
Yeah.
Fantastic. And he comes up with these amazing stuff. But he also, I think of him a little bit, even though he's a couple of years younger, I think of him a little bit as a mentor as well. Mm. He's really opened my eyes at ways of looking at things. And between the two of us, I think we've really helped each other in a lot of different ways. And yeah, so to answer your question, it was fast, man. It was unbelievable. But we sat down to play something and it was like, we don't really need to rehearse. We just need to rehearse to remember the words.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
To remember the words,
right.
Know what songs work together. It was one of those kind of things. It was so much fun.
Where did when you put it together, where did you rehearse with it? Was it New York? Was it?
No, we did it in London.
Oh.
It was beautiful.
Oh.
It was fantastic. And then once we basically got everything ironed out, decided the songs we were going to do, we moved to a rehearsal room up in King's Cross.
Uh-huh.
And that was fun.
Yeah.
So we only did, I don't know, maybe a week or two there after. But so we kind of knew what we were doing. I think there was a lot more to do in terms of how we were going to present it. There was a lot of stuff that needed to be done with, you know, the kind of lighting. I'll give a shout out to Kate Wilkins, amazing. People like us, Vicky, who did all the kind of collage back film stuff of, you know, Matt's family stuff as well as... Mm. You know, live things we've done in the past. So it was quite a big production.
Yeah, there was somebody that posted on Facebook that said that she saw you. Where did I read this? Pam. She saw the in Brooklyn. And said,
"Oh yeah,
it was
Brooklyn
amazing."
Steel.
Yeah, and said it was an amazing, amazing show. So you know, there were people that got out too.
Pam.
Yeah, yeah. So it's nice, you know.
Well, talking about the back, you know, back in the day, we asked you to pick a song that maybe we'd play during the show, and you had suggested "Love Is Stronger Than Death" from Dusk, from one of Dave's favorite albums back in 1993.
That record. I wore it out. I literally wore it out. It was one of my favorites, and I remember just riding around, just blew me away. So I could never get enough of it.
You can't wear that album.
Yeah.
Dave, you cannot wear that album.
So good.
It's timeless, man.
Yeah, very good. It struck me at the time, too, because it was unique to what was out there at the time. And it still holds up, you know. I was playing... one of the tracks is Dogs of Lust.
Dogs of Lust, which I'm pretty sure was the most popular song in America. It reached number two on the modern rock charts.
Great song.
That that's a fantastic song. By the way, Vinnie Caliuto
played on
drums.
Yeah, and Vinnie sounds great on that.
But you would recommend recommended we play Love Is Stronger Than Death.
Yeah.
Any particular reason why you mentioned that song? Does that resonate with you still?
Yes, there's a lot of reasons. First off, the lineup is fabulous. We've got Dave Palmer on drums.
Great drummer, by the way. Great drummer. Great guy.
I'm playing Hammond.
Yeah.
And Matt is playing acoustic guitar and singing. And Johnny Marr is playing the harmonica. So it's a really interesting combo.
Yeah.
But it's not just that. I think it's one of his best lyrics ever written.
Uh-huh.
It was written for his younger brother who passed away in 1999. Very unexpectedly. Very, very young.
Uh-huh.
And it's just a very, very powerful, timeless song. And I think probably one of the best songs he's ever written. I just think it's a fabulous song. And play it now and people will hear for themselves.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
Yeah, let's hear it, Taylor. Love is Stronger Than Death from The from 1993.
Love.
Still holds up, man.
Yeah, that's such a great and I remember Matt's vocal on that and just the sonic quality of that just blowing through my speakers and there was just enough compression and I don't know what they had on, but it was just knocked me out. I couldn't get enough of it. It was just a beautifully recorded record, and the songs were just so. At the time, there was just I wasn't hearing anything like it, and it spoke to me. And to this day, I actually go back in time when I was listening to it. I remember just loving it so much. So kudos on great work, man. You know.
Yeah. And by the way, I forgot to mention that the sound at the beginning and then comes back in the middle. That's a melodica, and Matt played that.
No kidding.
Fantastic. Yeah, that's a melodica with a kind of distorted delay on it.
Wow.
It sounded really cool.
Wow.
But it's a beautiful song. I mean,
it really is. That's great.
Just to tell people how cool a band the were. Their follow-up album to that in 1995 was an album entirely of Hank Williams covers.
Yeah,
which is cool.
You know, David Bowie. Yeah. David Bowie credits them as being one of his favorite bands of all time.
That album Hanky Panky, which was all the Hank Williams songs. I worked really closely with Matt on. We basically all we had to do. I mean, basically all the royalties obviously went to Hank Williams' estate. And we were asked if we could make change, and they said, as long as you don't change the lyrics, you can do anything musically. So some of the songs, we actually used the lyric and wrote a completely different tune.
Ah.
And it got fabulous reviews.
Yeah.
And people, really loved the album because it was just in honor of a genius songwriter.
Right.
And I had so much fun on that project. It was fantastic.
There was always this mystique about Matt. It was Matt as well that I thought. I don't know if they intentionally marketed him that way, but he was always below the surface. It's almost like he wasn't one of these guys that wanted to be up front. There was a curiosity about him to this day that I found really, really. I thought it was brilliant, and on his part, of course, like that doesn't fit me. So he would do what he would do just to kind of get, because I liked I guess his vibe was always just very sensational.
Yeah, but Matt is his own man. He will do it the way he sees is right, and he will stick to it, and he will do it even if it's not a popular thing. And that's part of why I admire the guy. He should be known as one of the best songwriters on this planet.
Agreed.
He's not.
Yeah.
But primarily probably because he doesn't necessarily go for that big publicity.
That's my point.
I kind of agree with you there. I can't stress enough how talented that guy is and how much people should listen to his back catalog. I mean, I've been on quite a few of it, but he's done a lot of stuff that I wasn't on that's fantastic.
Cool Factor.
Infected, great album. Yeah. So check him out.
Right. The Cool Factor with him is just on, beyond, it's just amazing.
What I think is amazing, and Matt obviously is that DC, this kid who spent the first 10 years of his life basically living in the jungle, has been a part of all this incredibly cool music.
Uh-huh.
And I just want to go back to kind of how you mentioned getting the Lola single and then getting a Deep Purple album.
Right.
But how you coming from the experiences you had where really music was not part of your life at all. And then, obviously you go to England in 1968, 69, which is a great time to be there. But still, you're a young kid. How did music become so important to you? What was there, when did you get serious about the piano? How did this?
And we need the John Lord story, whatever the Deep Purple you want to tell a little bit of that. I want to hear a little bit of that.
We'll give you a little bit of that story, too. But I think that the first thing to remember is that when I came to England, I was a kid of 9 years of age. I was on my own. I really didn't know anyone. I went to a school that I knew no one. It was a boarding school, right? And there's only so many things you can do to survive in that situation. And I would say that music kind of became my mother, my father, my everything. You know what I mean? Because it was something that just got to me right away.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I had a little bit of experience noodling on a pump church organ. And then up in the Cameron Highlands, which was pretty high up in the jungle, they did have the odd piano floating around. Down on the plains, you couldn't keep a piano in tune because it's 99 degrees. And
right.
Heavy. Just really, really difficult conditions to keep a piano, right? You'd need air conditioning. Nobody had air conditioning. We lived in little, you know, villages and stuff. So up in the mountains, there was an upright piano and it like noodle around on it. But I never really got serious with it until I started loving music, right? So then I just become this sponge. I just take in everything, and a lot of it's a bunch of crap, but it's everything. And then I'm starting to like, oh, that's what I like. This is what I like. You know what I mean? And so I was just bringing everything in, and it was just this kind of baptism of just something wonderful that I could kind of go into. And then the other thing was the piano. I could go into a room on my own, shut the door, and that could become a little world as well.
Yeah, sure.
I didn't start taking the piano really seriously till I was an early teenager. And I had some help from, you know, I was classically trained. So, you know, I'm at a boarding school. They're going to give you piano lessons, right?
Yeah.
And both my teachers were really, really good. And actually, my second teacher, he took me at the age of 13 from like about a stand. I don't know if you understand grades, but the beginner's grade is grade one. The highest you can go is grade eight, right? He took me from grade three in one term, one semester, to grade eight.
Wow.
And we're talking, I didn't even know he was doing it. He was just making pieces harder and harder and just, you know, building. He just it was amazing.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So he turns around to me and says, yeah, you're on grade eight now. And I'm like, what do you mean, sir?
How that happened?
What do you mean? Yeah, right. And it was, you know.
He
saw something in me, and he was able to impart it. The other thing that he did was he would, waiting for me to come to the lesson, I'd hear this music coming out. It'd be kind of some sort of jazz type thing. And it'd be these interesting chords. I was like, wow, what is that? And I'd quickly open the door without knocking so I could catch him. You know what I mean? Because he would just stop instantly. And I'm like, teach me that. He said, no, you can't. You have to teach yourself jazz. So I said, well, just show me that last chord you played.
Yeah.
So he'd show me a chord.
Right.
And that enticed me into looking at all styles of music. So that was a big thing. Yeah. So the story.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's actually not a John Lord story.
It's Deep Purple.
It's slightly different.
Yeah.
It's a Roger Glover story.
Oh.
Bass player.
For Deep Purple. Good guy. Yeah. I've met him before. Great guy. Yeah.
Oh, he's a wonderful
Brilliant.
Guy. And I met him for the first time in Los Angeles when we played there in 2018.
Mm-hmm.
And we sat and we had a few drinks together. And I said, let's get this out of the way right away. Your album was the first album I ever owned. He said, well, let's get this out of the way right away. That's the first record I ever made. So we had a hug and we became, you know, definitely very friendly and had a great night just chatting and talking about music.
Yeah.
And it was wonderful. And it was like, this has happened to me throughout my life where guys that have been kind of my heroes when I was a teenager, I wind up meeting them.
Yeah.
I mean, a great story was I was playing as a support band to a local band in Bath called Interview.
Yeah,
and it was right around the time when Peter Gabriel had Salisbury Hill
as his
first single solo hit,
right?
It just hit the charts.
Yeah.
And Peter Gabriel, being from that same area, comes on and he's got to do three songs with the main band.
Mm.
So he's there when we're sound checking, and I go up to him. I have this battered old little 73 note Rose.
Right.
He has a beautiful CP80, which in the day was the stage piano, right? A Yamaha CP80. And I kind of go over to him a little bit meekly, but I'm like, Mr. Gabriel, is it possible that I could use your... And I mean, I don't know where I got the balls. Is it possible I can use your piano to instead of my beaten up old Rose for the support band?
Right.
He said, sure.
Wow.
You can use it. So not only did he let me use it, right?
Yeah.
After the show, after he played and everything, he came back. He sat with me for an hour.
Wow.
He had no reason to do it. I mean, this is one of my heroes, right?
Yeah.
When Peter Gabriel left Genesis, I'm done,
I mean,
Peter, and then I started following him as a solo.
Sure.
I love the guy.
Yeah.
And he sat there and he talked to me about what he was up to, asked me what I was, and spent all that time. I mean, I haven't ever met him since that day, but he's all right by me. And that guy, I love him just for that experience.
Yeah.
Same with Roger. I mean, all these guys that turn up. I was once rehearsing, actually, to play with Alison Moyet, who you may have heard of. She's an English singer.
We didn't talk about any of that. I mean, you've done not an Alison Moyet, but Lisa, amazing stuff.
I was rehearsing with her, and in the next studio was Robert Plant. And to me, I mean, Robert Plant, I had Led Zeppelin on every single minute of the day for, I think, a few months.
Right.
You know what I mean? And then I wind up, I'm sitting in a pub talking to this guy, and he's a lovely bloke.
Yeah.
And it's just happened to me time and time again. And I've always been very pleased to say that none of the guys that I idolized as a kid I've met were assholes.
Yeah.
They were all great.
That's great, because it's always a little scary that if you meet one of your idols and they turn out to be a jerk. But so it sounds like in your case, that's never happened.
That's wonderful.
I've been very, very lucky. Yeah. And it's been very, very encouraging. And they've always been very encouraging to me. So I want to give a shout out to all those three guys.
Yeah.
They're cool bunch.
Yeah. Wow.
Hey, you were in a band, we're running out of time, but I like this band a lot. It's a very different sound than the and certainly than what you're doing now, but you were in a band called the Joe Boxers
in
the early 80s.
Great song.
Yeah, we could keep talking, but just Taylor, throw Just
That's
Got Lucky on in the background.
That's a great song. You know, I remember when this came out, and I think it was just around the time we were hanging out in London. And
this was
a little after that, but this was already made you it was a hit there, right? It was a hit in London as well.
Right.
But
the first record actually did even better. It's called Boxer Beat.
Right.
That in England alone, imagine this, in England alone, sold over 500,000 copies.
Wow.
Just the 45.
Wow.
I mean, imagine that today. That would be fantastic.
Amazing, yeah.
Just Got Lucky didn't do quite as well,
right.
But it did better over here, and I think it hit the top 40. But it was sort of what I would say a minor hit. But it's being played again. I think it was in the 40-Year-Old Virgin movie.
Yeah,
right. It appears here and there.
Great hook.
That was a great band.
Great hook. Didn't some of the members of that band go on to do... They all went off to do other bands. I think a couple... I forget the name of the band.
Well, this is another good story that I can throw at you right now. It just happened. So I'm in London promoting my album just a couple of weeks ago, and I get a call from Chris, who is the bass player. Now, what you got to understand is that the Nucleus band without the singer was Subway Sec.
Right.
And Subway Sec had Dick God on his Subway as the singer.
Yes.
Then that Nucleus band became Joe Boxers with Big Wayne, who's a black guy from Ohio, who was a rockabilly guy from New York called Buzz and the Flyers. So he came over and joined us, and that became Joe Boxers, right? So what happens, I'm in London a couple of weeks ago. I get a call from Chris, who's the bass player in both Subway Sec and Joe Boxers.
Yeah.
Oh, we're in the studio. Come by and see us. Subway Sec, Vic Gallo, we're making a new album. So the next day, I turn up at the studio. Within 5 minutes,
Vic has me playing
cutting a track, and the producer is Mick Jones of The Clash.
Oh my God!
So I'm having a wonderful time, right? So I'm there, and I swear, probably within the first hour, we cut 3 tracks, and then we sit down and talk for about 2 hours, drinking cups of tea and eating buttered toast.
Nice.
That's a very English thing to do. And just chatting about the past. So there's going to be a really cool Vic Gallo on the Subway Sect album coming out in the near future, so look out for that as well.
I'm so happy to hear that you're so busy. And Mick Jones, man, The Clash, you know. Yeah. You don't get any better than that band. They were just, what a band.
Mick was great.
Yep.
It was a funny situation, actually, because the band were like in the kind of recording room.
Yeah.
I was in the control room with Declan, who was the engineer, and Mick, who was the producer.
Uh-huh.
And Mick Jones is literally dancing in there. And I'm at a piano that's mic'd up. It's an upright piano in the control room. What a vibe.
Oh, man.
Great.
That's wonderful, man. I'm so happy for you. I mean, you're busy doing what you love, and it sounds like when I hear the music you just made and you're releasing in February, I'm really happy for you, man. You're a good guy.
Well, I appreciate it.
And it's wonderful. It's really wonderful.
These are kind of bonus things on the side, but obviously... you know, I'm Burger Man through and through, but also on the DC Collab front, this is a very, very serious project to me, and I really want to get it to as many people as possible, because I know there's an awful lot of people...
Uh-oh.
Did we lose DC?
Did we lose DC?
But I was just saying, he's got a song called White Witch Jungle Stomp, which he talks about the white witch being the mist that would come down the mountains of Malaysia. It would be kind of a cool song for Halloween, even though it doesn't literally talk about a witch, but yeah. It's kind of got that spooky feeling. And then he's got a song, Beware Mission Statement, which is just you really hear that rock and roll piano that.
Goodbye.
You know, you gotta love it.
Subliminal message. Oh, yeah. So we try to give us a message.
We come back.
But hopefully we can get DC back to kind of say goodbye to him. But you know, if you don't know the go back and check out their stuff. They were
it'll enlighten you.
Post-punk British band with some great stuff, and of course the incredibly talented Matt Johnson is the leader, really the only constant in the band. But right. DC's been with them for a long time, and then we just played a little of the Joe Boxers, which were a fun.
Johnny Marr was the guitar player.
Johnny Marr for guitar player. For the yeah.
And he played, known with the Smiths and all the other great stuff. And I think just recently, I think in the last couple of years, Johnny had a hit with his project, you know, so he's doing great things. And David Palmer, who has been Rod Stewart's longtime drummer, he's wonderful. So, I mean, that band back in the day, and now it's back doing, it's great to hear they're going to be doing a new record. And it's great.
And in the meantime, you can check out DC Collard's solo debut, which comes out in February. And
he's back.
Is he back?
He's back. So we get to say goodbye.
I am back. I don't know what happened there, guys.
That's all right.
Right?
It happens.
Technology, right. Hey, I was just saying, we didn't get to it, but I really like the song, The White Witch Jungle Stomp. I was just saying that'd be a perfect song for Halloween, even though it's not literally about a witch.
Right. Yeah.
But it's got kind of that Halloween kind of spooky feel, and I know you kind of wrote it about the mist that would come down the mountains, how it would, which is, just give a little sample of that. I know we're running out of time, but I just want people to hear it. This is a really cool sounding song. The White Witch Jungle Stomp from.
Mountaintops her fingers creep down through the trees as children sleep. She hears their longing thoughts forlorn as dreams are stolen by the dawn. Their eyes all share both fear and love. Her tendrils snake down from above. They cry, "We see the White Witch now." There's pain and joy across their brow. Sun has come to take her place. Of the White Witch there is no trace. She's crawled back up the mountainside into the clouds where she'll reside until another night rolls in, until another dawn begins. Enjoy this day, dear children all, for what awaits we dare not call. The White Witch Jungle Storm. The White Witch Jungle Stomp. All you kids from 6 to 93, do the White Witch Jungle Stomp with me. The White Witch Jungle Stomp. The White Witch Jungle Stomp.
So good.
Yeah, unfortunately, we don't have time to hear the whole song.
So good.
But
well, go out and get it. Go support DC Collard.
Yeah. That one's not available yet, right, DC?
Yeah, it's possible that might be the third single. So if you guys keep saying what you're saying, you'll encourage me to make that the third one.
Yeah, it's very good. Very good.
You can find it. You can sample it at dccollard.com or go on. The first two singles are available for purchase or streaming, but however you get your music, please support DC Collard because this is cool stuff. And the fact that you've poured so much of your own experiences and your own self into this record, it's got to be a little intimidating, I would imagine, to know that this is such a personal record. To wonder how people are going to react to it. Is there any sense of that?
A little bit, but kind of. I did what I did when I was a kid. I've kind of just walled myself off and just said it's going to be what it's going to be, and just deal with it. You know what I mean? But I felt that was the only way to do this and really be honest is just not to have any filter, just to let it out. And yes, it does make me very vulnerable, but so be it.
Are you a Pro Tools guy at your studio there? Do you, is that what your format
actually,
is?
Actually, I use Logic.
Oh, there you go. Logic. A lot of people have gone down to do that because of, I probably know why. But anyway, yeah, I was just curious about what format
it's a lot
you're using.
Cheaper than Pro
exactly.
Tools. You're allowed to say it.
Yeah.
Nothing wrong with it.
Yeah, you know, it makes
actually,
sense.
Actually, when I mastered, I went to a studio that used Pro Tools.
Exactly.
I used both to get the final product. But,
right.
All right. Well, we got to say goodbye. But before we do, I need one story, DC, from Dave about Dave from back in the 80s or the 90s. I need one good Dave story that you could share on the air. And Dave's pretty cool about anything being out there, right, Dave?
Yeah, sure. I hide nothing.
He hides nothing.
I hide nothing. Give us one story.
Okay. So you want one story about Dave. Okay. I'm going to tell you one story about Dave that he would really wish I didn't say.
Okay, please. Go ahead.
It sounds like actually. He's done so well.
Yeah.
He's given up all those old demons.
Yes, he has.
Can just look back at
oh, absolutely.
And
everybody
God,
knows.
That was me then. This is me now.
Yeah.
And kudos to you, Dave.
Thank you. Well done, mate. Thank you.
We're still here, both
Thank
of
you.
Us. Miraculously.
Yes.
Miraculously survived. Right?
Yeah.
So, yeah, the one story I can give was one of those little London ventures. And I seem to remember... We wound up in this pretty seedy pub in Notting Hill Gate.
Yes.
And I think I was asking around for some brown stuff. Is that correct?
Yes. It was the heroin
and
days.
I think, and I think that's what we did. We did a small time drug deal in the bathroom in the back of a pub.
It was seedy, funky. And that's why I couldn't wake up the next day.
That's the story. Yeah. There you go.
Well, there
Thank
you go.
God I don't do that anymore.
Well, you've both come through on the other side doing great.
We wouldn't be alive. I just read a book and they were talking about, you know, I read a book by Karen Slaughter and there was a guy in there that was living a life like I lived. And, you know, there's no way out unless you get out completely and I still look back now. I'm turning 64 and I'm thinking, God, I'm glad I didn't completely live my life like that any longer because, you know, what the damage you do to your body is just it's brutal. So I feel very fortunate and I try to take care of myself as best I can in that way. And thank God. And, you know, I'm so glad you're doing well. We're both doing well. Life is good.
Yeah, it is good. And guys, once again, I'd like to thank the three of you for inviting me on. I really appreciate it. And
we'll
keep in touch.
Yes, indeed.
And thank you for being on the great DC Collard. Go on his website, dccollard.com, and please check out his new album coming out in February, On a Mission. Thanks again, DC.
Thanks, DC.
All right.
My best. Yeah, it was fun.
That was great. And we are pretty much out of time. Yeah. I wanted to just get a hear stories about the Hooters in Florida. I know it went really well.
It went great. It's for another time. We did great. And looking forward to next year with our 40th. And things have been a lot of fun. So, you know... you know, they've actually had me playing a little solo.
Yeah, you're like John Bonham over there.
Yeah, it's fun. Well, not close, but having fun. And I'm surprised that I'm enjoying myself as much as I am. Right. And not playing with those guys, playing the solo. Having fun.
All right. Well, another episode in the books. Thanks to our sponsors, GotPeace.com and Corporate Sedan Service. Thanks to Taylor Behind the Glass. Thanks to Wildfire Radio. Thanks to Philly Rock Radio.
Yep.
For Dave, I'm Andy.
Yep.
We'll see you next time.
All right.
On In the Pocket.
Indeed.